The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. Well, it's the morning after the announcement that England is not going to go back into lockdown, which Boris Johnson made in the Commons last night, Katie. But he did announce that a number of areas would go into a sort of de facto lockdown, didn't they? Just explain what's happening.
Yes, so we have a situation where lockdown is going to end on the 2nd of December. But what replaces it, I don't think it could quite be described as, you know, ultimate liberty. It's quite far away from that. We have a situation where we're going back into the tier system, but they're bulked up tiers. So if you're in tier two, you are more limited than you were pre-lockdown if you're in tier two. And I think there's now quite a nervous wait, perhaps an agitated wait, particularly amongst Tory MPs, to find out what tier their constituency is going to go in. And I think tier three, I think you could argue, is not going to feel that different than what we just had for the past 4 weeks, particularly when lots of the areas that we expect might be in tier three, probably in tier three before, under severe restrictions for a while. I mean, there are pieces of good news. For example, gyms and all shops are expected to stay open in every tier now. But I think in terms of social contact, in terms of hospitality, it is really quite strict. And I think adding to it is the sense that this isn't, you know, we're going to review this every 3 weeks. I mean, they are going to review what tier you're in, but the idea of the tier system is here to stay for the foreseeable. So even though Boris Johnson was trying to use this common statement yesterday to have some optimism in terms of the vaccine breakthrough of Oxford, in terms of where we're heading to, what you kept hearing in the questions from Tory MPs is, look, you're announcing restrictions for months on end all the way to March. And I think that that's going to become more of a source of tension once we know which areas go where.
And there is a stop tier three campaign building on the Tory backbenches. James, do you think that the prospect of the vaccine will actually make that campaign stronger because people are starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel and just want to get there now?
I mean, the vaccine has an odd effect. I mean, in Whitehall, as opposed to Westminster, I mean, the general view is, look, it's clear that by April 4th, life will be much more back to normal. So why risk overwhelming the NHS at this kind of late stage of the crisis? Let's drive carefully out. While as among Tory MPs, I think there's a sense of April is still a very long way away. One senior Tory MP I was speaking to this morning was saying, look, these rules, even in tier one, not many hospitality businesses, this MP was arguing, are going to be able to survive until April based on trading in this way. I think it's all further complicated by Christmas. We know that they want to relax the rules at Christmas. I think the driving forces, I think they worry about, if you didn't relax the rules at Christmas, people would make their own rules. And once you'd had that kind of widespread disobedience, it'd be very difficult to go back to widespread compliance. But I think that makes things more difficult because the last thing they want to see is a rise in cases going into Christmas when they've set about relaxing the rules. So I think this is difficult. I also think what's difficult is because there are no clear criteria for where areas go, that this becomes, as Katie was saying, an inherently set of political choices. For example, what do you do with London? Is London in tier two or tier three? Obviously, London Tory MPs don't want it to be in tier three, but politically, if London is in tier two, while as lots of the great cities of the north are in tier three, people will say, it's one rule for London, another rule for that. So all of these things become complicated. I think the government, personally think the government would be in a much easier situation if there were a kind of set of automatic categories. You know, you had kind of something about rising cases, hospital beds, some kind of formula which you could use, say, right, that place goes into that tier and that place goes into this tier. And I think, as Katie was alluding to, I think you'll definitely have a bit of jockeying from Tory MPs saying, well, I can live with these measures as long as my constituency is in tier one or tier two, but if my patch is going to be in tier three, I don't think I can.
So it's COVID NIMBYism, basically, from now on. And the Commons will be voting on this next week, Katie. Keir Starmer didn't sound fully supportive yesterday when he responded to the Prime Minister's statement, did he?
No, he didn't. And he did raise concerns. And I mean, it fits into a pattern to a degree in the sense that Keir Starmer, even though he has supported some of the measures, is very quick to obviously point out failings of government and where they've made mistakes. I think that there is a difference, however, between expressing frustration with the government response and questions over all these methods and opposing it. And I still think the strong sense in government is that Labour will support these measures and therefore they can afford to have some Tory rebels. Now, if Keir Starmer suddenly comes out and, you know, and says we're not supporting it, that's a completely different landscape for Number 10 to deal with, because I think the numbers of Tory rebels then would start to really get to quite an edgy point. But ultimately, I think if you think about Keir Starmer's opposition, you know, things like the 10 p.m. curfew and others, you know, and that has been mended to a degree in this, is often pointing out smaller problems but agreeing with the general stance of it. And I think that Labour generally are supportive of restrictions in terms of like health first. They would say, you know, before the economy and prioritising. So it's hard to see, even though as much as there are some Tory MPs who have long hoped Labour could work with them to force the government's hand, I don't think that's currently what figures in government think is the most likely scenario next week.
And James, this week we have the spending review. Can that do anything to assuage Tory MPs' fears, or is that going to make things worse?
Well, I know we had one absolutely jaw-dropping number yesterday, which is the amount of money this financial year going to NHS tests and trace is going to be £22 billion. That's more than the police and fire budgets put together. And it is just a reminder of how remarkably expensive some of this COVID spending is going to be. I think on Wednesday, I think you need to work for the IFS to work out that the kind of borrowing figures that the Chancellor are going to announce are going to be kind of eye-wateringly high. I don't think this is when we're going to begin to see things be paid back. I think one interesting thing to watch is what happens on international aid. We know that Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, is keen to kind of move away from the 0.7. And the question is, you know, how do you do that? Now, I think this is kind of an interesting argument, actually, which is you've already seen, you know, Jeremy Hunt, the former Foreign Secretary, Andrew Mitchell, the former International Development Secretary, Ruth Davidson, the former leader of the Scottish Tories, all coming out saying, no, this is not a good idea. But I think there is something difficult here, which is for the Tory party, which kind of will need to confront, which is the increase in aid spending up to 0.7% of GDP was essentially part of a Cold War peace dividend. If you look at the defence review published last week, with the big uplift in defence spending, higher than what was promised in the Tory manifesto, you see a strategic decision taken by the UK government that basically great power competition is back. And so essentially the Cold War peace dividend is over and you need to start spending seriously on your military again. I think there is a kind of choice here. If the Tories wish to be kind of fiscally credible, at some point you have to make these choices. And I think it's hard to say that you can have both a ramped up, heading back towards Cold War levels of defence spending and keep your aid spending level at 0.7%.
And finally, let's just look over to the States, where finally it seems the transition period is actually going to be starting now that Donald Trump has given what I think is probably the closest to a concession that we're going to get. Katie, what kind of appointments are we seeing from the Biden administration that are of interest to those in Westminster?
Well, we're starting to get a few rumours of appointments. And as you say, we're now entering the transition period. I think that probably the biggest name so far is Anthony Blinken, who is Biden's Secretary of State nominee. I think you also have John Kerry being reported as someone who's going to be helping on climate change and the environment. I think that if you're thinking about how this affects the UK, I think the good news on the Secretary of State nominee, if you're trying to find good news, but this could also be bad, is he has actually met Boris Johnson, something Boris Johnson has not done with Joe Biden. So some say, oh, there is a connection there. But at the same time, Blinken has been quite critical of Brexit. I think that when people try and point out, you know, where they might disagree, I mean, I think anyone Joe Biden appoints being critical of Brexit, in a way, it's kind of priced in because the Democrats have been very critical of Brexit. So I think in terms of that kind of appointment, the government know they have a problem there, but ultimately it is the UK's position on Brexit. It's just, can you work a way around it? And it goes back to a very, you know, well-trodden point, though I think perhaps first made by James, which is the idea that where the UK thinks it has the most common ground with Joe Biden is on the environment. And that's why, you know, COP26 and going forward are going to be crucial to that. So you can see, you know, there'll be a big effort to make inroads with people like Kerry going forwards. But I think in terms of Trump's concession or close to concession, and what it actually affects. I mean, the UK government made the choice pretty early on to start congratulating and accepting Joe Biden as the winner. Not every government across the world has done that. And I think there are some who thought, you know, they might hold out for even longer. Yes, there were a few awkward interviews in the straight aftermath of that US result when it wasn't clear and Dominic Raab wouldn't really say anything. But they did get round to offering congratulations. So I don't think it is so substantial in that sense. But one of the frustrations on the UK side in the build-up was trying to work out who to make inroads with on the Democrat side. I think the UK embassy was not alone in having that problem. It was common with other countries too. So now you're starting to get those names. I think there's been quite a lot of work behind the scenes to try and build those ties. James?
As Katie says, Tony Blinken is obviously, you know, long-time Biden aide, critical of Brexit. It's not no great surprise. I think perhaps one interesting thing is he was educated in France. He speaks fluent French and is, you know, reportedly kind of quite close to Emmanuel Macron's team. So, you know, that will definitely be seen in that light. I mean, the John Kerry appointment, as Katie said, you know, COP26 is, you know, Boris Johnson's putting huge store in this. It's kind of Brexit, Britain's coming out party. And the fact that the US government is sending a former Secretary of State, a big hitter, to be a Sherpa on that is obviously good news. It does raise this question about whether kind of Alok Sharma has sufficient international star power in terms of this event.
Talk Alok Sharma down, James.
If the US is sending a kind of former Secretary of State, former presidential candidate, you know, does Alok, we've got Alok Sharma on the line for you, kind of quite have that. That I think, well, I mean, there'll be some mutterings about that amongst some Tories who quite fancy that role for themselves. I think Michelle Flournoy at Defence, you know, she's, you know, well known in Whitehall. I mean, that will be kind of reassuring. Jake Sullivan is interesting given his role in the Iran deal and given how the UK has kind of still maintained a very European position on the Iran deal. I mean, there's obviously a kind of, you know, E3 post-Brexit, the E3, I think, with, you know, the UK, France and Germany and the EU high rep, that work on Iran, I think, will become kind of particularly important to the UK, given that the UK hasn't gone down the road of trying to set up some kind of formal foreign policy consultation with the EU. That, and so obviously what happens to the Iran deal, Jake Sullivan's appointment suggests it's back on, is interesting. I also think Jake Sullivan is interesting in that there is a slight divide in Biden had 2,000 foreign policy advisors during the campaign, and there's a slight divide on the China question. Jake Sullivan is definitely more to the side of thinking that the era of great power competition is back than some other people, and that could prove really quite significant.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And thank you for listening.